Studio 360.
Around the time of the 2016 election, I was sort of experiencing in real time this sort of horror of what I saw as, you know, dirty dealings or corruption.
That's the singer-songwriter Liz Phair, and she says that disconcerting time, the moral and cultural confusion and ugliness she saw, drove her to reflect on the notion of character, including her own.
If character is so important, which it became to me after I watched what was going on in politics, what does that mean to establish a character? How do we become who we are? I think it's the stuff, it's the slings and arrows we take on a daily basis that we don't even barely acknowledge to ourselves that can shape us in fundamental ways for years to come.
25 years earlier, very young Liz Phair had begun tape recording some songs under the name Girly Sound, producing homemade cassettes.
I woke up alarmed.
Those tapes got her a deal with Matador Records, a hot new label that put out her debut album Exile in Guyville in 1993. Among other things, Guyville was a savage critique of the male-dominated music scene in her hipster Chicago neighborhood, Wicker Park. The album was confrontational, sexually explicit, and became an indie rock icon.
Help me, Mary, please. I've lost my home to your thieves.
Since then, she's only released five more albums, but since that recent epiphany around the presidential election, she's moved into a second creative lane, chronicling profound moments that shaped her character in a memoir she's just published, her first book, called Horror Stories.
When I felt all those artists dying around 2016, people that had been formative for me
in terms of Bowie influences. And
Bowie and Prince, and it felt like the hits kept coming, like I was losing the star firmament that mm-hmm. had meant something to me that mm-hmm. I just took for granted as part of the world. And my manager really said to me, he's like, are you making the album that you would want to leave behind if it were your last? You know, like, are you doing work up to that level? And I really didn't feel like I was, and it was a challenge. So the book became that challenge. Like, if this is my last artifact, I want you to know how I felt about life and what was important to me and what mattered and stuck with me.
Well, and of course, once one gets to be, say, 50, one does
right.
one does that more. But it's
yes.
it's the thing, you know. People who are 25 should ask themselves that, you know.
But they never will. They're having too much fun, and I'm happy they're having so much fun.
Horror Stories isn't a conventional history about the makings of albums and the ups and downs of stardom. It's this set of distinct episodes from throughout your life, these short, rich narratives depicting meaningful moments, climbing a tree at your grandparents' house, this break-in at your college apartment, an encounter with a Trader Joe's employee. So how did you decide on this form, this approach?
Well, I think that because I'm a songwriter, I tend to think in discrete chunks. And so as I was writing prose, which was a much different experience than the way I would normally write lyrics, there's a world building that a 3-minute song doesn't really, you can hint at it, but you can't really flesh things out. And with prose, I think I just naturally gravitated toward like almost like a stretched song style. Huh. So I kind of saw them as contained moments.
So this sort of becomes an album that you wrote down, and it's a...
Yes.
Yeah.
In my mind, it's very much an album of long-form writing.
It occurs to me that the stories, the way they draw meaning from these simple, small moments as opposed to big, dramatic, you know, that time I met Elvis moments or anything, I was reminded of the song Stratford-on-Guy from Guyville, which is this beautiful song about flying home to Chicago and about the airplane and the flight attendant.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a memoir? Was that a bit of autobiography, that song, for instance?
That was. That absolutely was. I had that exact experience while I was flying in and wrote a song about it.
I was flying into Chicago at night, watching the lake turn the sky into blue-green smoke. The sun
mean, that's the beauty of being an artist, is that you can capture your memories and preserve them. You can polish them and burnish them until they kind of exist on their own, sort of outside of you.
That song had a fictional version of itself on your earlier tapes, where the plane crashes, right?
Yeah. And it's like, that was an earlier iteration of that song. And I wrote it about this kind of crazy notion of being on a plane that was imminently going to crash and sort of terrifying your fellow passengers, like, oh, you better get ready because this is going down. And I don't know what made me write that stuff. The girly sound material was so fanciful. It was so whimsical in a weird way and dark. It's a weird aesthetic I have. It's a high contrast aesthetic.
You can pretend the plane's gonna crash in 5 minutes.
Well, that's funny that you say that. Not that it never existed before, but this combination of whimsical and dark seems to be a very alternative rock Gen X sort of thing, you know?
You know what? I never thought about that, but I think you're absolutely right. I think that's the zeitgeist I grew up in, and that definitely has taken root and colored my artistic output. You're absolutely right. That is like an indie rock Gen X thing.
Good. Thank you for confirming that. So do you ever like, wow, I wrote this when I was 21 or 22 or whatever. Are you still able to connect with the you that wrote that song as an adult, as a 50-year-old?
I mean, I can't connect with, and I do envy that sense of freedom where you just had nothing to lose. Mm. You could just, like, throw anything against the wall. You just had no I miss that sort of confidence. Like, you don't know all the things that could go wrong. You don't know what you're incurring upon yourself with every action. Whereas when you're my age now, you kind of do know how things work out. You're like, well, I know how this story is going to turn out. You know what I mean? Like, you don't have any of that when you're young. And I miss that. But I also, I am impressed that I can see why this was my career, because the songwriting chops themselves in some of the early work, it's hit and miss. Believe me, it's really strongly hit and miss. I never thought anyone was going to hear those tapes. But there's good songwriting in there, songwriting that I don't think I can recreate now. So some part of me was smarter than I am now. Some part of me had a better grasp on making great music.
Or again, as you're suggesting, music that only a 23-year-old can make.
Can make, yeah.
So you don't ever feel like, oh, I should go back and change that line or revise this there?
Oh, God, I would trash whole songs. I would, like, if I could, I think I said that on stage in Australia, like, be careful what you scribble in your journal because you might just have to be performing it at 52.
Yeah.
Oof, you know,
like, yes, right.
Be careful what you do.
Before you were Liz Phair, the musician, you were Liz Phair, the visual artist.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of art were you making?
Well, my father was an infectious disease specialist, and as soon as AIDS sort of broke in the 80s, he was called upon to spearhead and form a protocol for these patients that were coming in that were dying of these terrible illnesses. So I sort of heard over the dinner table all this stuff about healthy people suddenly contracting terrible illnesses and they couldn't do anything for them. And I became focused on this idea of, where is the self? We tend to think of ourselves as our physical, corporeal selves. But if you're battling disease or something is wrong with your physical self, where do you go? Like, where do you retreat into, and what is the essential you? So I started doing these big charcoal drawings. I think I started with this little kid who had leprosy, and you saw the progression of the leprosy. He went from being like a sporty soccer-playing little kid, then he was overcome by the skin infection, and he was disappearing. And it's very heavy. Sorry.
Yeah. Why did you leave it for this career in music?
I accidentally got paid for music. I wasn't going to do music. I was still making art in Wicker Park. That's what I did. That's how I paid my rent. I would sell a drawing or a painting, like, to friends. And then all of a sudden, you know, I was making this record, and I got a check in the mail, and everyone loved the music, and it literally was like that. And I remember calling my dad saying, like, hey, you can take me off the health insurance. I mean, that was a big deal to me. So it just kind of, it took over.
I'm back now to continue my conversation with Liz Phair, whose debut album Exile in Guyville was released in 1993. It immediately became a sensation in the rock world, the indie rock world. It won the Village Voice's annual poll of music critics as the best album of the year, beating out Nirvana's In Utero. All this for a young woman who'd just been recording cassettes in her bedroom and had rarely played any shows in public.
He's just a hero in a long line of heroes, looking for something attractive to save. They say he rode in on the back of a pickup, and he won't leave town till you remember his name.
So you put out this record, and it does well. And you're famous. You were 26, I guess?
25.
Were you prepared for that, more or less? Did you deal with it as well as a 25-year-old?
No, I did not deal with it well.
No?
I did not deal with it well.
No?
I didn't expect... I really wanted to make an impression in my neighborhood. I wanted to impress the people that I went out drinking with or went and saw play and perform. What happened was, you know, my ambition for the neighborhood became a national platform. And that was not something I remember being very traumatized by the photo shoots because, you know, I had some risque lyrics, you know, I had some sexually frank lyrics in a couple songs. What that translated to in terms of a photo shoot, like people were putting me in topless and waders and being like, yeah, show the sex, do the sex, you're the sex girl. And that was not what I thought I was doing at all. You know, I knew I was being shocking, but so were a lot of indie rock bands at that time. This just was coming from a woman and kind of a goody-goody woman, and it freaked everybody out.
I ask I'm a real cunt in spring. You can rent me by the hour. I know all about the early pilgrim thing. Entertainers bring Mayflower.
But what I intended to do was show that I was unafraid. A girly sound, which was what I was doing on cassettes, was a political project that I did at Oberlin. I would speed up the tape so my voice sounded even girlier.
Huh.
And I was like, if I say really shocking, horrifying things in a really girly voice, you know, the young female voice arguably has the least authority in society. And, you know, would they hear me if I was doing a little sing-song, but I was saying really, I can't say it on the air right now, but, you know, would they even hear it? And that was sort of what that was born from, this idea, this Oberlin political feminist idea of like, say really shocking things in a little girl voice. And what does that do? What clash is that?
What if you hadn't become Liz Phair in 1993? And what do you think would have happened?
Thank you for saying it that way, because that's how it feels when I have to call on a telephone call and I have to say my name. I never know how to say my own name, but I feel like I ought to be saying, it's Liz Phair, you know, like that's how it feels. I think I would have been either like I might have run a gallery or something. I like the idea of getting dressed in something like architectural and going to work and glowering at you over my cigarette.
Being like, mean and scary. Yeah.
I mean, I've now taken on this life where I expose myself for a living and sort of put it all out there to get liked or hated. And I do something that I'm really much too shy to do, which is get on stage and perform in front of a band. I mean, if you had known me as a girl, none of that would have been what you would have expected for me at all. And so in a weird way, I do have this nostalgia for the road not taken, but don't we all? Like, everybody does. And would I have been happier there? Probably not.
There is this 90s nostalgia uptick lately, you know, shows being rebooted, fashion being, you know, reintroduced, all that. Are you nostalgic for the 1990s?
My take on that, there's always been nostalgia because people are always looking for inspiration, so they look backwards as well as forwards. So there's always been that nostalgia for each era. But I think what's going on with the 90s revival, because it seems a little bit more, it's sticking longer and it's a little bit more of a deeper feeling, this really want to return to the 90s. I think it's the last time before the internet.
Yeah.
I think it's the last time that we weren't all isolated and connected in this isolated way in our own homes. We're connected, but we're not really connecting. It was the last time that, like, people had to walk to the record store mm-hmm. to pick up something or go to the show and stand there and meet people and make friends that way. Like, it was the last period before we became hooked up to the wire.
You know, tyrannized by the robots.
Yeah. Tyrannized by the by the artificial overlord, you know. I think that's what it is.
So at what point in this career of yours that began when you were 26 did you say, oh, okay, I like this. I'm good at it. I can go on stage and do this.
Oh, my God. Only recently. Really. Like, I had so much angst about my job. Like, why did this happen to me? And I'm not good at it. And why am I doing this? And I'll never get back to the life that I thought I was going to live. And then I had my son. And as you're teaching a child about life, like, here is a sidewalk. You step up to get on it. You know what I mean? Like, little things. Mm-hmm. Because the focus is off the self.
Sure.
When you become a parent.
Sure.
I'm gonna tell my son to grow up pretty as the grass is green and blue, smart as the English channels were.
And I took a different perspective and I thought, your job is to go on stage and sing and people clap because they're happy? Like, that is not a bad job. And so kind of around Lilith Fair and that whole pop period was when I really kind of embraced it. I thought, this is an excellent job.
It's interesting you say it was during this change to popier music that you became comfortable, because it seems like it might have been a low moment. You put out your fourth album in 2003, the first one for a big label, and it had this much more mainstream sound.
Yeah.
And a lot of your fans who so strongly identified with your original alt-indie mid-20s self felt betrayed by this poppy record, and critics derided you as some kind of sellout. Is that a wound that still hurts?
It doesn't really. And even at the time, it did suck to hear, like, interviewer after interviewer kind of have to go through a therapy session with me because they were personally angry. And
yeah.
I didn't relate. I didn't understand why. It took a long time for me to understand why they were so angry, because to me it was just music and I was in a different part of my life. It would have felt disingenuous to try to pretend I was still a young indie rocker, like, on the streets, like, hustling. That would have been not true to what I was doing.
Right,
but
right.
I think to them, the betrayal had to do with a larger cultural shift
mm-hmm.
where, like, we're just talking about the 90s, like, alternative did mean something. And I think they had a much more political investment in it than I did.
It totally makes sense. It was that this alternative era had ended and now, you know, everybody selling out, no longer meant anything. It was probably, yeah, you became a scapegoat for what was happening in the culture.
I didn't shoot to make a pop record. What happened was Matador had sold us to Capitol. And so all of a sudden, I was left on a major label to sink or swim. And so I swam.
Right.
I didn't hate it. I learned a ton. I learned how to perform because they put me on these radio shows and on these big bills. And I just had to learn to do a lot of stuff that I never would have had the opportunity to do. So I'm kind of grateful.
I'm so tired of moving on.
That, as you know, is a song released last year by the performer known as Snail Mail. So Exile in Guyville has become this archetype and template for a wave of young women making music. Her, Soccer Mommy, Frankie Cosmos, others. Lindsay Jordan, a.k.a. Snail Mail, even used to play in a Liz Phair cover band, I read. So when and how did you become aware of all these Liz Phair acolytes?
I found my goddaughters, as I like to call them, on social media. I just started connecting with people on Twitter, and I would just follow all these young female artists because I was interested. There seemed to be so many of them, and they all seemed so fearlessly unique. And I remember being that age and feeling like I had to kind of look like the guys and like the same things that the guys liked or whatever it was. And this felt like all these butterflies just springing up, like each one was doing their own thing and they had a vision for who they wanted to present themselves as. And it seemed to carry through in their talent and their songwriting. So I was just mesmerized by this wide field of young women doing their thing. So I wanted to kind of find out about them and interact with them. And then they were all very complimentary to me, seeing me as someone who had, you know, done what they were doing and helped make it easier for them to do what they were doing. And it just was like this mutual clasping of hands across a generation. And I felt like suddenly, like as if I had spoken a language that very few people spoke. And then now in the world, a lot of people speak that language. Mm-hmm. And it just felt like a home that I'd never had when I was coming up. It's just very cool.
And you've toured with some of them, right?
I've toured with some of them and I see them out and it's just, it's a happy time. They might tell you a different story. They might tell you how sexist the industry is and how awful it is.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't be wrong. It's just that it was worse. And it's better now. So I'm just enjoying the moment of being able to look at all these young women doing their thing and just be happy and just feel like the world is more like what I wished it always were.
Liz Phair, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much for having me and for your thoughtful questions.
Liz Phair's memoir, Horror Stories, is just out. She also told me that she's in the middle of recording a new album, which will be her first in 9 years.